Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, December 26, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape on this. Is this Boxer Day? Boxing Day? Reboxing Day? This is the day that you rebox your gifts and bring them home, bring them back to the store. Is that right? Reboxing? What is Boxing Day?
I just know it's Canadian, but I don't really know.
Well, to celebrate Boxing Day in Canada, we of course have the quintessential Canadian guest, and that is the American DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, Eric Foner, the one of the premier writers of the Reconstruction, I think, probably in the country. Would you say that?
Oh, yeah. He wrote the book on the Reconstruction.
Well, then I was correct. And as you know, the Reconstruction took place in America, which is next door to Canada. That's why we played it today.
Well, I want to correct myself quickly on that. It's the UK that does Boxing Day, not Canada.
Oh, God. We're going to have to re-record all of this. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you had a wonderful Christmas, if that is the thing that you wanted to have a wonderful time doing, in however way that you celebrated it. We are on vacation this week. At this very moment, I am undoubtedly somewhere in Michigan and am just trying to recover, constantly trying to recover. That's all I'm doing. I didn't even have a chance to get injured. I'm just constantly in a state of recovery. I'm there with my in-laws, who are great. They're great. So I'm really enjoying myself with my kids, and it's great. It's really great. I don't in any way. It's so great. I'm having such a great time. I can't even express it. Sit back, enjoy this interview with Professor Eric Foner. This came from February 8th, 2008?
Yeah.
I think it was sometime in February of 2017. It's one of our best ofs. Basically talking about radicalism and the opportunity the left has today. This was very shortly after the, not that shortly, but certainly shortly after the inauguration. So people were still in a mild state of shock as opposed to the deep, deep state of shock that we're in now. It didn't get better. It only got worse.
Just different kinds of shock.
Yes. Ongoing shock. Now, presumably, we don't have to get into that. I don't want to even speculate what's going on when we're on vacation for 2 days after Christmas. God knows. All right, sit back, enjoy this. Also, know that all this, the rest of this week, there's best of YouTube. Or best of, really, some stuff that we did from the fun half. I mean, it's not really necessarily YouTube. It's going to be audio.
It's mostly fun half stuff.
Fun half stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to love it. Matt is totally on this. And what do you got? Like funny stuff? Like
it's pretty much all funny stuff. Yeah, not going to be a lot of vegetables.
So funny. The most funny. Really great.
A lot of the clips where I say funny things. And
oh, my God. Matt is so funny on the fun half. Folks, don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member, going to join the Majority Report. And you'll have access to all that funny stuff from Matt. He's not funny on the front half of the show. So I threatened him. I said, save it for the premium part of the show. That's the way you work business. You don't give it away for free, right?
Just have them assume you're funny on the part that you can't hear.
That's right. See that? Matt's very dry on this free half. All right, folks, enjoy Eric Foner. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program Eric Foner. He is the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, author of many, many books, but most recently, The Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad, also author of Nothing But Freedom, Emancipation, Its Legacy, and Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877. Professor, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Good to talk to you, of course.
I want to talk a little bit about your piece in The Nation magazine of late, American Radicals and the Change We Can Believe In. But let's start with just the idea of does America today, or I guess let's even start with what is radicalism?
What is radicalism? Radicalism depends on the moment you're talking about. Things that are radical in one era become sort of common sense in another. In other words, I'm against positing a timeless definition of radicalism, like it has to believe in abolishing private property, or it has to believe in, you know, some other specific thing at any time, at any moment. Radicalism is the sort of, to my mind, the left wing of the any particular social moment, and the people who are demanding fundamental change in the society. So it differs from reformism, liberalism, which wants incremental change, it wants more far-reaching change, but you have to analyze it in historical context. That's my point. And, you know, that article you mentioned was stimulated by my experience teaching a course at Columbia a year ago on the history of American radicalism, and it ran through 200 or more years of American history. But, you know, radicalism changed over time, and that's one of the points of the course.
Have we always had radicals in this country?
Yes.
So they're always there.
They're always there. Every generation has them. They differ among themselves, obviously. Sometimes they fight among themselves. But this has been a persistent theme in American history.
I mean, I felt like the 90s were devoid. Much of the 90s. I mean, and by the end, it seemed to there seemed to be some pushback there. But what? What was the radical movement in the 90s?
The 90s. The 90s was a pretty conservative decade, even though Clinton was in power, who's a lot more liberal than, you know, than Reagan, who came before him, et cetera. I think in the 90s, really, the key radical moment was at the very end of the 90s, the
WTO,
the Seattle protests, and really putting on the agenda all these questions about globalization, about inequality, about climate change. You know, I think if you go back to 1999, I guess it was, the Seattle demonstrations really opened up a whole bunch of questions which became much more crucial in the 21st century that we're living in right now. You go back before that, you know, the 90s were a funny decade because with the end of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the end of communism in Eastern Europe, there was a kind of ethos, which obviously proved to be totally false, that history had ended, you know, as Francis Fukuyama said, and that there was only one possible way of organizing life, that is, with democratic politics and free markets. It was supposed to be the era of democracy, and in some ways it was, although democracy seems to be on the retreat nowadays. Radicals were sort of, I think, quiet for a while because they were trying to come to terms with a completely new situation and figure out what radicalism should be in this very new political situation after the end of communism.
Let's talk about to give people a sense of the scope of what constitutes radicalism and the abolitionists as radicals.
I start with Tom Paine, who's sort of your quintessential American radical at the time of the American Revolution. You know, he said a share in two revolutions is living to some purpose. He was in the American Revolution, the French Revolution, a guy who completely challenged the existing political order, attacking monarchy, aristocracy, and also putting forward programs for economic equality, which were quite radical for the 1790s. And then you go up through the abolitionists. I put a lot of emphasis on the people who struggled against slavery for two reasons. One, slavery was deeply embedded in American life. It was not, it was really the basis of the American economy for a long time. And it wasn't just a little footnote like we sometimes prefer to think. And the abolitionists really pioneered the sort of modern radical methods of how to change society, you know, going out and with pamphlets and petitions and speeches and newspapers, and you might almost say operating both above ground and below ground at the same time. They had all these public events and, you know, working within the system in that way, but they also violated the law. They helped fugitive slaves, which is very much against the law. They had this kind of underground activity also, the Underground Railroad, we call it. And so they kind of operated at both levels at the same time, and I think that's an interesting lesson for subsequent radicals, even today. You know, people who are opposing Trump's, you know, policies on immigrants, on refugees, are going to court, which is right within the system. But on the other hand, they're also, you know, offering sanctuary to people, saying we're going to help people who are banned by the government. Whether that violates the law or just says we're not going to cooperate with the law, it is very much in the abolitionist tradition.
So I mean, if we're talking about radicalism as a dynamic, right, between the status quo and others' belief, I mean, when a person gets radicalized, right, by changing events, you know, because it seems to me that we've got two things going on here. On one hand, we've had a nascent, and then maybe, you know, one could look at this actually getting born at those WTO protests and maybe then put on hold briefly because of 9/11 and sort of a pushback there, but then reemerging and particularly as a function of the financial crisis. We've got this sort of nascent movement on the left and particularly amongst the youth. And then we're then met with sort of these, I think we could say, radicalism on the right, which could also radicalize a whole nother set of people, but not necessarily in the same way that those pre-existing radicals. Am I making sense here?
No, I hear what you're saying, absolutely. And, you know, radicalism exists on the right, and right now it's sort of obviously dominant in some ways, although the first couple of weeks of Trump's administration have shown the existence of a very big radical resistance tendency in the country, which I think is all to the good. I think the main point you're making is two things. One, radicalism tends to emerge in moments of crisis, you know, when the existing system seems to be delegitimized, such as by the financial crisis of 2008. You know, all the talk about how globalization was solving all our problems and everything was just hunky-dory, you know, that became to be seen as ridiculous in lies. You know, we'd been fed lies for 20 years by our presidents and others about how wonderful the economy was working for everybody. And the crisis of 2008 sort of showed it wasn't. That opened the door to the delegitimation of the existing ideology, opened the door to new ones. There's no guarantee that they're going to go left, right, or any other direction. You have the Occupy Wall Street and movements like that, which, you know, were much more on the left wing. And then you have the Tea Party and others, which and feeding into Trump's campaign, which go in a very different direction. So the sort of cracking up of the system does not necessarily lead in one direction, but it does open the door for new possibilities. And I think, you know, radicals of the left have to seize that opportunity, which exists today because of the crisis of 2008 and what followed.
And what of, though, the idea that I can, you know, I'm just to use slavery. Slavery is an institution that was, you know, was embedded, fairly static reality there at the birth of the country through through the economic explosion of the country via cotton in many respects. And so if I'm a member of that society, I turn against that institution. What if that institution did not exist and then gets implemented by the status quo, which then radicalizes me? I mean, because that's what I'm saying.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. Historians have enough trouble figuring out what did happen than worrying about what didn't happen. But I think your point is, you know, what is it that makes people turn against an institution that is part of their life? It's normal. It's not, you know, it's not that most people were pro-slavery. It's that they just took it for granted. It was part of society, you know? I mean, I often ask my students, well, go a century ahead, and what will people a century from now look back and and say, how the hell could they have accepted this or that in 2017 as just a normal part of life? But, you know, it may be 100 years from now, something we think is a normal part of life will seem absolutely intolerable to people. And it's radicals who make it intolerable. In other words, it was the abolitionists, you know, who were a very small and often despised group at the minute, at the beginning. You know, one abolitionist editor was killed by a mob in Illinois. Their meetings were broken up by mobs. We shouldn't think that suddenly everybody turned around and said, oh, yeah, slavery is pretty bad. We got to get rid of it. It took a very long struggle to persuade a large number of Americans that slavery was, you know, something that needed to be abolished. You know, that's really the transition, seeing something that you have previously accepted as just a normal part of life and suddenly saying, no, no, this is intolerable and we have to get rid of it. What radicalizes people? It really depends. Sometimes it's an economic collapse, like in 2008. Sometimes before the Civil War, it's religious conviction. People go to religious revivals, and the preacher preaches against sin, and one of the sins he's talking about is slavery, and sometimes people wake up on that. Sometimes it's just encountering a fugitive slave and putting a human face on what is often an abstract institution. So, you know, there are many, many things that kind of galvanize people to think in new ways.
Without asking you to sort of divine the motivation or the intent of, like, people who are marching, I guess what I'm getting at to a certain extent is, when people go out and march against Donald Trump, are they fighting for a radical vision of the country, or are they fighting for just a return to the status quo?
I don't think they want the status quo, but I think...
The status quo that existed before
they
Trump.
I think they know... right now, it's a lot clearer what people don't like than what they do want. We don't want what Trump is offering. And the people who mobilized the Women's March of hundreds of thousands of people, the demonstrations after the immigration ban, those brought together a lot of people with a lot of different ideas. They could unite in opposing what Trump is doing, but if you sat them down and said, what positive vision do you have for the future, I'm sure you'd hear a lot of different things. Radicalism has to move from, you know, saying no, which is important in a situation like today, to saying, okay, here is what we want to do and we want to have. And it's not just going back to the status quo. Many people were quite disappointed with the Obama administration and the status quo that preceded
right.
Trump. So, you know, I don't want to just go back and have another Obama administration. And in a certain sense, that's one of the big reasons Hillary Clinton lost. She was just promising people another 4 years of Obama. And they were tired of what Obama was peddling for them. So we've got to have a positive vision, and it's going to take time to... develop that.
How does that develop? Because when I look at sort of when we've had those moments where radicals have won in many respects, it seems to me we're in an era where the amount of imagination we need to fundamentally change what people are were rejecting from the Obama era and the era that preceded it is greater in many respects. And I don't know. I mean, I guess you would have a better sense of this. But it's one thing to say we want to abolish slavery, and then there were others who said, "Well, it's not just enough to abolish slavery. We actually want to have equal rights." I mean, and we're
That was the abolition position, and that's what made a lot of them unpopular. You know, there were plenty of people who were perfectly happy to attack slavery, but were also deeply racist, and they
right.
were worried about slavery's impact on white people. To convince them that really the issue is equality, not just slavery, racial equality, justice for people, not just saying, okay, you no longer are a piece of property, important as that is, obviously. And to get the society even to take steps in the direction of genuine racial equality, which did happen in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War during Reconstruction, was a heroic struggle. I think one of the lessons of this history, you know, history doesn't teach exact lessons, but one of them here is that, you know, all triumphs are kind of partial. In other words, radicals never get everything they want. They get something, and then they have to continue to struggle on other fronts and other issues. It's never, you never reach a point where you say, okay, great, we've got what we want, now we can go home and, relax. The issues are always out there. New challenges emerge. That's why it's a dynamic process, as you said.
You quote Gramsci, the old order has died, but the new one can't be born yet. Where are we on that spectrum?
Gramsci, the Italian thinker. Yeah, I mean, that's where we're at. We're in the middle of the death of an old order, which still exists like a vampire, you know. The old order of financialization of the economy, of globalization being the answer to everything, of, you know, human beings being just considered factors of production. You know, hey, if you lose your job in Ohio, well, just move to Silicon Valley and become a computer programming. And that doesn't hold water anymore, you know, if it ever did. So people have lost faith in that dominant idea of the 90s and early part of the 21st century. But what is the alternative? You know, to me, Trump is not offering an alternative. He's offering a lot of rhetoric and stuff. So radicals have to offer an alternative. What do we want? And how do we get there? You know, they're doing that on specific issues. We know we don't want this Muslim ban. We don't want to turn the clock back on the rights of women. But what we do want positively is still to be determined.
I mean, how does that happen? I mean, how does this is there an order for these things to happen?
No, I don't think there's any rule. I think that what it has to do is come organically out of kind of grassroots movements. I mean, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement to me is a very important thing. It didn't, you know, nobody founded the Black Lives Matter movement. It wasn't like a group of leaders coming together and saying, okay, here's what we're going to do now. It came from the grassroots. It came from ordinary people just getting fed up with the way the police were treating African-Americans in community after community across the country. And, you know, people took to the streets, and, there's still plenty of problems with the police, but I think Black Lives Matter has actually had a very salutary impact in many communities on how they operate. But, you know, so there's a radical position which just developed organically out of people's struggles on the day-to-day level, and in a way that may be the best way for it to happen.
What is the means in which people can become sort of to the extent that we more broadly in our society have that struggle, the idea of wealth inequality, the idea of stagnant wages, the idea of not having health care. I mean, this sort of development that we've seen around the world in many respects, at least for economies that are as developed as ours. We're not participating in that largely, right?
No, we are way behind the curve, obviously. Now, of course, plenty of those countries you mentioned have a lot of problems right now also,
sure.
But we are, we're an outlier in basic social health, social welfare, education. You know, we just don't do it in any adequate way.
In some ways, it seems like...
You know, but that's been a progressive program for 100 years. Go back and read the platform of the Progressive Party of 1912 when Theodore Roosevelt, the so-called Bull Moose Party, when Theodore Roosevelt, not a radical, but he ran on what was really a blueprint, his platform for 20th century, you know, social policy. And we haven't come up to what they were demanding in 1912. So, we got a long way to go on these issues. But then you have to ask yourself, is something more needed than just to list a specific things? Yes, we should have universal health care. Absolutely. Every other country in the world has it, at least advanced country in some form or another. Even Obamacare is way short of the mark. It was a step forward, but not adequate fully. The way we assist the poor is quite inadequate compared to other places. But those are, you know, I think that one of the challenges is to move from those specific questions to a broader, well, what kind of broad changes in how our polity and our economy operates would be necessary to produce those things?
And, where can we find clues?
Where can we find what?
Clues to what to
Yeah, we can find it in history. That's why I teach about the history. How did the abolitionists mobilize? How did the feminists mobilize? How did labor mobilize in the 1930s? We can't just go back and recapitulate what they did, but we can learn lessons from these different kinds of struggles. The first lesson is it takes a long time. The abolitionist movement was a movement over a century, maybe, if depending on how you date it, or half a century. The struggle for women's rights from, you know, even the right to vote from 1848, Seneca Falls, to 1918, 1919, you know, the granting of the right to vote in the Constitution. I mean, that's 70 years or something. So people have to look at this as a long-term project, not just, hey, by next year we'll be solving these problems.
Do you have a sense, I mean, relative to Europe, I mean, it seems that Europe was ahead of us from sort of an, I guess, a social safety net, but less so in terms of empowering people who were not, I mean, having a more, I guess, heterogeneous society. I mean,
they don't. Well, now they're becoming more heterogeneous,
right,
and that has led to a lot of social tension, as we know. I don't say we have to just model ourselves on Europe. There are some aspects of European social democracy that are very valuable, and there are other elements of European society that I don't think we want to emulate. We can learn from other people. Obviously, that's one of the one of the things in American culture that is most debilitating is the notion that we're so exceptional that we have nothing to learn from anyone else, and that's just parochialism and closing your mind off. On the other hand, I think at some points in American history, like under the old Communist Party era, there were people who were on the left who just said, well, let's just model ourselves on this other country over there, whether it's the Soviet Union or some other one. No, I don't think that's the way to go either. Every country has its own particular configuration and history, and, you know, we've got to figure out a solution within the context of American society, not just saying, let's plunk down what they have over there, here.
Is there a historical precedent for sort of the type of era that we're living in right now, where we have seemingly the majority of the country against
you mentioned my books on Reconstruction. I think we need to go back to then. You know, in Reconstruction, you had a very forward-looking interracial democracy created in the South for the first time. The laws, the Constitution were changed to give African Americans equal rights, at least on paper. You had a functioning interracial democracy for the first time in American history. And then you had a backlash. Some people feel we are living in like 1877 again, where things were taken apart and things were rolled back. And, you know, the lesson is, you can never take accomplishments for granted. Laws on the books are not enough. You know, they've got to be enforced. You got to live with them. So in a certain sense, I think I hope if we don't go through the whole post-Reconstruction process of the late 19th century, but we can at least understand this principle that rights can be taken away. You know, we can't just rest on our laurels.
Indeed. Well, Eric Foner, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Very nice to talk to you.
Really appreciate it.
Let's play a clip of someone who is not a sane, normal, terrestrial human. And I think this is important. Look, far-right Israeli politics have always been important to track for several reasons. One, because the reality of what modern Israel is. There's a siege in Gaza. There's an occupation in the West Bank. It is absolutely functionally an apartheid state by any rational, fair reading of that word. And if you are a modern person of any variety, I mean, there's one party in Israel that could even be recognizable on a map of what we would consider to be sort of like proper Obama-era democratic opinion on inclusion, and that is the Meretz party, which is considered to be quite to the left of the Israeli spectrum, and Bernie Sanders has endorsed and aligned with them very much to his credit. And they are not radical, they're not binational democracy people, but They are very strong in some ways on ending the occupation and on equal civil rights for Arabs inside Israel, which is a serious civil rights issue as well, also for Ethiopian and African Jewish people as well. There's real racial issues there. Number two, and I'm not in any way excusing, like, look, the project of occupation has absolutely been a broader Israeli one that's cut across the political map. That said, the Israeli right, and even connecting down to their funding sources with people like Sheldon Adelson, and also a broader assault on the Israeli safety net, the Israeli social model, which does exist or did exist. I mean, it's no Benjamin Netanyahu is not only an ardent sort of, you know, bigot and promoter of quote unquote greater Israel. He's also a prime architect of Israeli austerity and increase in Israeli inequality. So when you track the Israeli far right, you could see Trump coming. You could see the move of this kind of global ethno-state far-right nationalism. And I certainly say it as someone of partial, you know, Jewish background. It is totally depressing to see a state that, of course, you know, was founded in a way that displaced tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of Palestinians out of their homes, and was discriminatory and ethno-state focused from the beginning, no doubt. Also, on the other hand, of course, was something that arose from people who were victims of one of the greatest genocides in global history. And it's quite depressing and devastating that a group as historically marginalized, oppressed, and abused as Jews, that we could participate in this kind of politics. But at this point, it just is what it is. And we got to look at it through a proper power lens and not an emotional one. And the final point I want to say is that, you know, Ben Shapiro has gotten a lot of energy. The New York Times said he was, you know, the cool kid's philosopher. There's this notion that this kid is some type of real rigorous thinker.
Cool means something very different than it did when I was in school.
Yes, I guess even if we're being super generous, I'm not getting the cool factor here by any remote stretch of the imagination. But look, so when the Trump administration did this move I'm missing this sheet. I printed it. It was a sheet of a variety of things that Ben Shapiro said about Arabs. It's in the Current Affairs piece by Nathan Robinson. When they announced that Jerusalem would be recognized as the sole capital of Israel, which is a long-term goal of the right here and the right in Israel, it has led to outrage and uprising in the Middle East. It's formally solidified that obviously the United States, which has always been, of course, significantly pro-Israel across all administrations, we are now going to just sort of formally accept that obviously we're not going to be any type of arbiter for a two-state process. Now, the two-state process is absolutely dead, and the Palestinians in the West Bank, which were the only faction left that had an even nominal, or actually really, in fact, quite serious commitment to the 90s process, they're saying what the only obvious response is, which is like, okay, we're going to live under your occupation. We're going to demand full civil voting and equal rights and end to occupation, which, of course, means that the choice becomes apartheid or full binational democracy for everybody. That's it. And here is Ben Shapiro on Fox News this morning, really just displaying a kind of fear-based, utter lack of any contextual information on the issue and a kind of like broad, casual bigotry about Palestinians, of which you can pretty much not do with any other group in modern American discourse.
Actually make the announcement. So today, we're going to get it today officially at 1 o'clock, but it will remain a divided city. That won't change. Does that bother you?
Well, I mean, it will remain a divided city because the fact is that the authorities have basically allowed terrorism to spread among the Palestinians, and East Jerusalem has largely been occupied by the same people it's been occupied for the last seven decades, namely Muslims who live there. That part of the city is very dangerous. It's been very dangerous ever since I can remember, long before I was born. The fact is that when I visited Israel for the first time when I was 16 years old, Israeli soldiers had to guard us as we came out of the tunnels under the Western Wall into East Jerusalem, which, again, the capital of Israel. If you are a Jew and you walk into East Jerusalem, your life is in danger. If you're an Arab and you walk into West Jerusalem, there's no problem at all, which signifies exactly why Jerusalem should be under Jewish control.
Actually, that's totally not true. I'm going to say that several years ago, in an analogous security situation, it has not gotten significantly worse. It's gotten a bit worse. I was in East Jerusalem. I stayed there. I had a lot of falafels. And people were really nice, and absolutely nothing happened.
Is a falafel a type of attack from behind?
It was an attack from a 10-year-old Palestinian kid who was serving me at his dad's restaurant. I needed to be protected by an IDF officer who promptly broke the kid's limbs in front of me so I could feel safe. And then, you know, look, Palestinians are safe in Jewish areas. Inside the occupied West Bank, there are Jewish settler groups that also engage in terrorism, as recognized by the State Department, almost always with IDF soldiers at the very least looking the other way. There's systemic abuses of Palestinian children. There's even a new motion in Congress, finally, by a congresswoman in Minnesota to actually address it. That's how bad it's become. There's different roads inside these territories. And we're not talking about Jerusalem anymore, but back in the occupied territories, which could only be thought of as analogous to the Jim Crow South. And inside greater Israel, inside Israel, inside 67 borders, there has been far-right thug movements that have targeted not only Arab Israelis, but also as I say, people from Jewish backgrounds, but from Ethiopia and broader Africa. There's pieces of legislation that were being drafted up to target even Israelis that might just be inclined towards being members of a peace movement, as an example. So this is just complete nonsense. And yes, there's soldiers all over the place, and sometimes there are attacks, and that's terrible. There's nothing compared to what happened in the Intifada during Sharon, not even remotely. And in fact, at this point, Hamas barely even engages in these activities anymore itself. What you see mostly recently is kind of like random acts of violent desperation, which, as we always say, are inexcusable and can always be contextualized if we're being serious about understanding the issue. And I just want to say, I mean, look, this is, and Ben Shapiro has a, you know, obviously a, you know, racism is done because Jim Crow is done and black people have bad culture and all the kind of usual tropes that I guess you'd expect from a cool kid philosopher. But I do think that, you know, and I'm looking for this on my phone, so please bear with me because I lost the sheet, but this really just needs to be said. And this is Nathan Robinson from Current Affairs. And Nathan Robinson makes a very smart point that, you know, Ben Shapiro and a lot of these guys now do the preemptive move, which is like, oh, you're just going to call me racist. You're just going to call me a bigot. Now, yeah, I think sometimes people are definitely on too much of a hair trigger with those words. Even when we're rightly calling something out, we still need to do the legwork. So what Nathan Robinson is doing in this great piece, the quote-unquote cool kids philosopher in Current Affairs, which I'll tweet out again later. And what I'll do here is we're going to call Ben Shapiro, certainly I consider him absolutely a racist towards Arabs, probably towards black people as well. And it's because when you say things like, Israelis like to build, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. That's a racist statement, and I'll explain to you why. If I need to. Because, first of all, you're making a broader innate claim about two broad categories of people, which is demeaning and insane to begin with. Secondly, you're referring to photos of bombed out Arab Palestinian villages where, yes, in fact, people might be living in complete squalor because they don't have access to things like medical care and because white phosphorus has been dropped on Gaza, which has like a population density of Queens. I think that plenty of Palestinians would be quite happy to build if they were given the opportunity. And in fact, the West Bank, even by, you know, Tom Friedman standards and run by not only Palestinians who have not allowed terrorism to flourish under their sort of quasi-semi-autonomous control, which is, he claimed before them, the Palestinians in the West Bank have implemented every type of neoliberal economic orthodoxy you could imagine. And of course, it hasn't solved a lot of problems, but it certainly has led to a lot of building things. I've been to Ramallah, and it would shock you how many hotels and cafes and things are in that place, even under a place of complete non-autonomy and occupation. And then, you know, of course, you know, he's talking about seeing children in Gaza swim in sewage. And Nathan Robinson says it would be like saying, wow, Haitians must really love dying in earthquakes, since a lot of them seem to have done it. And he goes, I am reliably informed that Shapiro is a master of logic, so I'm sure that there's more to this than mere simple-minded prejudice. Back to Robinson. Shapiro's thoughts about Arabs are all along similar lines. Usually conservatives are careful to draw a distinction. They are not condemning an ethnicity, but rather adherence to an ideology. We're very familiar with a lot of people who play that game, namely Islamism. Not so with Shapiro. For him, the only problem is not Islamism or Islam writ large, it's Arabs. The quote, this is back to Shapiro, the Arab-Israeli conflict may be accurately described as a war between darkness and light. Those who argue against Israeli settlement outposts of light in a dark territory argue for the continued victory of night. Arabs value murder, while Israelis value life, where light fails, darkness engulfs. And those outposts of light are, in many cases, you're talking about ultra-right-wing settlers who rip up plants and trees that Palestinian farmers have cultivated for ages. You're talking about people, in some cases, you know, flying in from Brooklyn, throwing rocks at Palestinian children and bulldozing their farms. I guess that's an outpost of light. And of course, Palestinians have engaged in terrorism. And of course, there's many problems inside Palestinian internal politics. This is why we don't make categorical, stupid statements about any group of people otherwise. But we recognize reality, that there is a fundamental asymmetry. And even with, at the times, and it hasn't been this way for quite some time, going back to at least 2002, 2003, when, yes, there really was a drumbeat of Hamas atrocities inside still a broader context of Israeli oppression and occupation, there is no reality-based assessment of that situation that does not recognize the fundamental asymmetry of power there. And the casualness of racism in the discourse here empowers a move that is so reckless that even the Saudis, and they partially have to because of their position, but they've strenuously condemned it, even as the Trump and the royal family have been running interference for each other since the beginning of the administration. What people like John Kerry or Ehud Olmert or Ehud Barak, for that matter, have said about the Israeli situation becoming or being an apartheid state and losing any type of international legitimacy and respect is basic observable reality. And why the New York Times quote-unquote cool kid philosopher would fail to understand that with his Aristotelian logic maybe requires a follow-up piece in the Times. The trouble with having conversations like this in the United States and debates in general is that we have a disproportionate number of deeply stupid people that influence public life. And one of those deeply stupid people is a guy, a YouTube pundit, a fellow YouTube pundit, by the name of Dave Rubin. Now, I've never really thought to say anything about Dave Rubin beyond making fun of him. I guess he used to be on the Young Turks. Sam Harris' disciple does a show where, you know, he interviews people like Milo and Ben Shapiro, and it's all honestly, I haven't watched much of it. It's all very boring.
It's a good show. It always turns out that the offensive white guy was right all along.
Right. There's always this weird process by which somehow, you know, grotesque bottom feeders that make their living bitching about a woman Ghostbusters or saying that African-American studies departments are ruining the planet or, you know, I don't know. Anthony Cumia not having a serious show is like the greatest threat to freedom of speech and freedom of thought in the history of the planet.
And other ideas you want free exchange of.
Yes, and other ideas you want free exchange of. You know, I do think it's interesting if you ask these people, like, hey, you know, say they're on their, you know, rocking chairs. They sit back and watch the rising sea levels. And they say, like, hey, what did you do during the age of Trump and unprecedented assaults on the public and global terrorism and mass and austerity and a global climate crisis? What I did was I did segments about how kids at Oberlin didn't like racists, but that they were the bad ones. That's what I was focused on during that time. So Dave Rubin, and you know, he has nothing worthwhile, and it's all this, you know, classical liberalism, free exchange of ideas, blah, 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 jerk off stuff. And he just does this sort of basically like, it's a conduit show. It's kind of a soft alt-right show, in my opinion, just kind of basically, you know, as they say, has on a lot of guests. And, you know, and then he does the thing where, and he clearly, you know, he has no idea what he's talking about. He'll say he supports single-payer healthcare, but then kind of roughly describes some other system. You know, he endorsed Gary Johnson, sort of the perfect meeting point of genuinely dumb and breathtakingly cynical and deeply boring.
But and how well Jesus treated the Muslims?
Yeah, Jesus treated Muslims well. He didn't have a problem with Muslims, and he was around plenty of them. That's another thing that you could look up that Dave Rubin said. And there's a big market for this stuff, and there's nothing terribly, like, starting with Sam Harris, who I would say, I mean, Sam Harris is in an entirely different intellectual league than Dave Rubin, and I will acknowledge that. But there is, a market for this notion that there are these really challenging and hard ideas that actually somehow confirm all of your biases. These really controversial opinions that actually underpin the status quo. These really unsettling things that actually mean in a real college environment that you just won't be exposed to any type of challenge to your ideas and privileges. I'm not that far out of college, frankly, okay? And yes, I went to a liberal arts college. There were conservative students. There was everybody. They could say what they wanted. But you did see in some classes, maybe people were thinking about their position in the world in a way that they hadn't before. God for fucking bid. So he's, but there's a big market for this, and you know, it's easy and it's comfortable with the fake allure of being challenging. There were nothing more rewarding and a great market to constantly have your confirmation bias confirmed in a way that suggests that you're actually on the edge. It's a great marketing position. Mother Jones recently did a piece about how, you know, I think this is, you know, actually a limited angle, because direct funding mechanisms by things like Patreon or Indiegogo can support everything. They can support things that are much better and more radical than what you might get in mainstream press. But the focus on this happened to be on how alt-right and far-right extremist figures are able to get direct funding from their fans and escape, you know, the Fox News syndrome. Or, you know, other outlets where if they go too far, you can target their advertisers. And as part of this article, Josh Harkinson referred to Dave Rubin, who does incredibly well on Patreon, as a member of the far right. I guess for the obvious reason that Dave Rubin basically has a far right show. Where he gives platforms to a lot of extremists. I think he also had Yanis Varoufakis on recently, so maybe that's what the how he can insulate himself. But this is from Mother Jones. Rival crowdfunding site Patreon has been more welcoming than the far right. It now hosts Rubin, that's Davey Rubin, Cernovich, Southern, Baked Alaska, and a number of lesser-known figures such as alt-right sci-fi novelist and video blogger Brittany Pettibone. Jesus. Yeah, I no need to mention all these idiots' names. Rubin had a meltdown, and he tweeted this. Oh, can you? That was already up? I don't know. Was it up? He said, I'll just read it. Hey, Josh Harkinson, your article is libelous about me. Expect a Republic attraction from you and Mother Jones. He also tweeted to Clara Jeffrey, Mother Jones' editor-in-chief, I expect a retraction and a correction on this libelous piece. The pundit also shared the definition of the term libel. And so basically his big answer is that he cannot possibly be a member of the far right because he supports legalizing pot and he's gay.
I'd like the textbook definition of classical liberal because this is the second time.
This is
the second time in, I think, one or two months, because Cassandra Fairbanks, too, was also upset that she got caught throwing up white power hand signs in the White House press briefing room.
Right.
That these free speech defenders who might describe themselves as classical liberals, very quick to take recourse to libel laws, which, I mean, I thought free speech activists weren't super big fans of that. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's like, unless somebody is whining that they didn't get booked in college to do their like brand new like anti-transgender material, all of a sudden everything else seems to be very quickly put on the table, like accurately describing Dave Rubin's show. Now, to be fair, Dave Rubin might be genuinely stupid enough to not understand what his politics actually are. And I have a good example of this. Dave Rubin is so hackish and so unoriginal that he is also a practitioner of the oldest and laziest, and yes, sorry to say, Dave, far-right tactic imaginable, which is, hey, you remember that Martin Luther King Jr. guy? You know what he would be today if he was still alive? A conservative. Watch Dave Rubin make the case.
You know, I think about this stuff. I really do. I mean, I
pause it.
This is what I do for my life. So
I sort of believe that you think about this stuff, which is why you look so confused all the time. Go ahead.
I worry about what's happening in Western society, about whether our successes have led us to a place where we're just giving it up. Where young people think that socialism is cool, that this leftist nonsense is cool, that the oppression Olympics is cool, that suddenly segregating based on race is cool, that the ideas of Martin Luther King and JFK that were true liberals, the liberals that I believe in, that these ideas are becoming old school. Martin Luther King and JFK would most likely be conservatives by today's standards.
I'd like to read from JFK. This is after he accepted his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo in 1964. He observed that the United States could, quote, learn from Scandinavian democratic socialism. He then talked about the need to confront the class issue, which is incredible because if you go back, Martin Luther King Jr. was now doubling up on two parts of the oppression Olympics. One, civil rights for black people, and then adding class to it. He also confided to his staff, and this is 1966, you can't talk about solving the economic problems of the Negro without talking about billions of dollars. You can't talk about ending the slums without first saying that profit must be taken out of the slums. You're really tempering and getting on dangerous ground because you're messing with folk den. You're messing with the captains of industry. Now, this means we're treading on difficult water because it really means that what you're saying is that there is something wrong with capitalism. There must be a better distribution of wealth, and maybe America should move towards democratic socialism. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, at the end of his life, was organizing on a class basis along with race and condemned imperialism in Vietnam. I am confident that Dave Rubin does not know any of this stuff and did not bother to look up any of those quotes.
Can I libel him a bit more? In addition to far right, I just want to reiterate the point that if you
describe yourself as a free speech absolutist and don't understand the paradox of being quick to use libel laws, then you're a charlatan or a fraud.
But and also a moron. I want to keep insulating us from this by really emphasizing that I totally believe that Dave Rubin is absolutely stupid enough to genuinely not know what he's talking about and think he was libeled. As my buddy Dick Coughlin said, it's the war of ideas. And in that war of ideas, Dave Rubin's Grenada. But I just do want to say, there is one good thing that's come out of David Rubin's work. And that is the birth of a new character. I really do worry about the fate of Western civilization. You know, when Anthony Cumia can't do good N-word material on Sirius XM, we know that we're giving in to Sharia. And we don't hate people. We're not racist. We just have a problem with bad ideas. Which is why we think Muslims should be spied on and hit with drones. And now there's the Oppression Olympics. People all of a sudden want to sit at a counter at Howard Johnson's, even when there's a perfectly good counter across the room. It's the Oppression Olympics. Sad.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
Have you tried? By the way, Jerry Seinfeld, who's one of the great observational comics of our time, can't even go on college campuses and talk about gay French kings anymore because college campuses are so out of control. And, you know, I think about this stuff. I worry about it.
I worry about Western civilization. Who talks like that?
Western civilization is in
read some about it,
the
then?
Balance.
There's a whole...
Read what? Vala who? Who's Voltaire? I was just having dinner with Ann Coulter and listening to Milo make some incredibly funny jokes about having sex with men from Jamaica. I think I understand Western civilization. What an unbelievable, breathtaking fucking moron. And if you tweet at me, look, we've been saying for months, and people have been tweeting at Dave Rubin that either I or Sam will go on his show. I think he's savvy enough to know that he couldn't handle that. But if you tweet at me that I'm unfair and I'm misrepresenting his ideas, just go your separate way. I no longer want to have an exchange of ideas with you. I really think we hang in the balance. And you know, Jesus knew all sorts of Muslims. I really think that if Gandhi was alive today, he'd be campaigning for Carrie Johnson and contributing columns to Breitbart. Also, another thing that I'm sure that Dave Rubin has no idea about is that there are Dalits or untouchables in India. MLK was very influenced by Gandhi, which actually helped develop his strategies for nonviolent resistance. And he agreed, actually, that just as there was restitution and some provisions made for people that had been untouchable or Dalit class, that there even needed to be some things like maybe potentially affirmative action programs for African Americans. Sorry, hate to break it to you. This is an old joke, and it's been used for a lot of people, but I'll use it for Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin is what people who hate white people think all white people are like. All right, let's take another call.
All right, last call of the day. Calling from a 785 area code. Who's this?
Yeah, this is John Connor from Los Angeles, California.
What's on your mind, John?
I wanted to make a comment about the charter schools. The reason that charter schools are failures is actually because the same reason why urban public schools are big failures. It's entirely comprised of low IQ, like city-dwelling minorities. You know, it's common knowledge that blacks score lower on standardized testing. Rich blacks actually score on the same level as poor whites. And I know this is triggering to liberal progressives because, you know, kumbaya, we are all one. But there are huge differences in race, and that's why you see urban cities with such horrible scores. And that's why you see such differences in performance by races.
Right. So you're saying like poor whites in Appalachia, they do very well in school.
they do on the same level as rich blacks.
Really? Where are you getting your data from?
Really? It is common knowledge, Sam.
Come on, where are you getting it from?
Really? I mean, come on. You're a white person. You should know better. We're going to need citations.
Why do you assume that I'm white? Why are you assuming my race?
Because you're racist.
Well, maybe.
And
I mean,
that's the basis what's of your race? Common knowledge.
What's your race?
Why does my race matter? Why are you deflecting the argument?
Well, because I want to know if I'm talking to a smart person or not.
Why does it matter?
Excuse me. Did you just say that there is an IQ difference between races?
I definitely said that.
Okay. So I'm asking you, I want to know if I'm talking to an idiot or a smart person, so I need to know your race.
What does my race have to do with me being an idiot or a smart person?
You just told me it was predictive of intelligence. So what is it? What's your race?
On average.
What is your race?
It doesn't matter what my race is, Sam.
What are you talking about? You just told me that race was determinant about intelligence.
What does my intelligence matter? What if, okay, let's say
I don't know if I want to talk to a total moron. So I just want to know what your race is.
I'm white, Sam.
What?
Whoa! Got me. You got me.
Okay, so listen, you're really super smart. Tell me where the citation of where you get your facts from.
You want me to just list out every one of them on every
no,
different
just,
source that I have?
Couple.
How much time do we have here?
I mean, enough for you to cite at least a couple of places.
Are you going to turn the music off? Or are you just going to make a mockery of this because you have no real argument?
Mockery.
This is what liberals often do.
Go mockery.
Okay. Go with the mockery.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. What's the citation?
I'm not going to, play your game with this. If you want to actually have a real debate, then we can have a real debate. But if you're just going to play ridiculous music,
I just turned off the music and asked for the citation of your facts you've just presented.
You're really hurting me as a white person with how dumb you're being, okay?
Like
I was getting into the higher. Yeah,
what's,
come
life.
On. This is where it was the Abbott and Costello.
And he had the little prepared little statement. To,
come on.
I want to really
so wait a second.
You.
Hold on. Now listen. I don't mean to trigger you because you're obviously getting upset about this. So I want you to just take a deep breath. And just tell me, give me a couple of citations about the facts. Quick, you got to be near a computer, right?
Why would I be near a computer right now?
White people have
all of
white,
these facts.
White people
have. Wait a second.
Wait, white
second.
People have computers.
Hold on.
It's common knowledge.
You call up with an assertion, and I'm asking you just to give me some citations of your facts. And you're going through all this rigmarole. You want me to turn off the music. You don't want me to make a mockery of it. Okay, sir. Let's hear the facts. Where did you get these facts from?
There have been lots of research done on this. It's not going to be, from, Harvard University.
Phrenology
Today. There's lots of universities
today.
That people have done theses on this subject. And there is research that
there's
shows
people
that
have been doing
true.
Thesis. So you're telling me that I ask you for a citation of the facts that you're stating, and you tell me there are people who have done theses. Oh,
in
thesis.
Various research in universities, yes.
Oh, in universities, really? Would
yeah,
you say
really.
These are prestigious universities? I mean, you should say. People have done,
university in your opinion?
Very prestigious people have done
college?
Very prestigious. Don't, hey, listen, don't get so triggered by me asking you to back up your facts. Just calm down, all right? I know this is, you're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up now, just calm down.
Are there black people near you right now?
Are you in a safe area?
In a safe space.
Are you in a safe space?
Again, you're just making a mockery of this again.
Yes,
listen, if you're going to call in and you're going to make an assertion like that, like anybody, I ask for the facts. Because you tell me it's common knowledge,
And frankly, I think, you know, at this point in my life, I have a good sense of what's common knowledge. I'm not aware of that. And now I'm aware that
I'm aware
sure,
of university theses, Sam?
I've just heard about
all the university theses.
But okay. my point is, you should say prestigious university theses.
Have you read The Bell Curve before?
There it is.
Of course, Charles.
Finally,
Murray.
The dumb fuck with his one citation.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Yes.
Have you read it or not?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. All of us in this room have read The Bell Curve.
So if you've read it, what does it say? What was the research that was done?
It's highly discredited.
Like, very much so.
In fact, I think if I was actually to Google The Bell Curve, it would be about how it's full of shit. Let's see.
You know who says that? The American Psychological Association. And who runs the American Psychological Association?
Not just the American Psychological Association.
The Jews.
Oh, the Jews, right, of course.
Yeah, it's a bunch of crypto Jews. A bunch of crypto Jews, just like you, Sam.
Crypto Jews?
I don't think there's anything crypto about Sam's Judaism.
What do you mean, crypto? What's the crypto thing? Are you Jewish, sir?
You try to hide me.
Dude, you are bringing down the white race IQ every second you speak. This is becoming embarrassing even to me. Yeah, Richard Spencer needs to silence you. You're a moron.
You're saying that I'm trying to hide my Judaism. On the very show that I have mentioned my celebrating Passover probably three times.
He talks about being Jewish.
On the very show where there is a camera that shows his face. You're saying he's hiding his Judaism.
Wait, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Say it again. I'm sorry, people.
You're a cultural Jew. That's why. It doesn't count.
Hey, can I ask you a
question? Wait a second. What do you mean? I just told you I'm celebrating Passover. It's a holiday. I say the prayer.
Common knowledge.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
I take off all the high holiday Jewish religions on this show.
Caller, what does it feel to be a victim of white genocide?
Are you a virgin?
Let me ask you something. Let me ask you a question. Hold on, let me ask you a question. What do your theses say about Jews and their IQs?
Ooh.
No, wait, I'm just curious.
Yeah, what about it?
Well, I'm asking, what do they say?
Jews have higher IQs on average.
Do you think that I have a higher IQ than you?
Good day, sir.
No, but back to our conversation yesterday when you said that you would punch me in the face, I think that I would definitely beat the shit out of you.
Well, no, wait a second.
Sounds
now,
like
wait
it.
A second. Now, wait a second.
Would you like to work in Angola?
That was a thought experiment. It was not, I said I would punch you in the face. I was saying, what would be the difference if I punched you in the face versus if you punched me in the face? And at the time...
The difference would be is that you would basically slap me. And it would be a lot different if I punched you in the face.
Okay, and why would that be?
Remember we were talking about, like, power dynamics?
Yes.
Remember that?
I do, yes.
Right, there you go.
What do you mean, there you go? You got to finish the sentence.
He'll kick your ass.
He's saying he could beat you
He's
up,
He's saying
Sam.
He'd
this
beat
is
you
like,
up. It's common knowledge.
Let me ask you a question.
There's been theses written Let me ask you a question.
Are you watching on YouTube?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, look at me. How does it make you feel to see this metrosexual Jewy cuck?
Just drop the metrosexual. Just Jewy cuck.
Express... absolutely no concern about you beating me up.
I mean, you are a new male, though.
I am a what?
You're a new male beta cuck. You're a pansy sissy. I bet that you enjoy watching your wife with other men.
I mean, maybe just
only if I can read the social security report while it's happening. I mean, to keep my mind occupied. Dude, are you actually this? No, I mean, I know. I honestly have a question, and it will appear as somewhat of an insult, but it's a genuine question because we do have people who call into this show as jokes. Are you actually this much of a total belligerent moron, or is this a joke and this is someone we know and it's a good character?
Do you think that that's a valid question to really ask?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say it's common knowledge.
Absolutely.
It's a common knowledge question.
Well, listen, I appreciate this.
I invite you to the live show next Saturday,
listen,
though.
I appreciate this exchange. Free ticket. But my wife is meeting her lover in a half an hour, so I've got to get wrap things up.
It's a Dominican guy this week. Sam's very excited.
All right, make sure that you don't stray away from your cuck shed. Make sure you stay in there.
That I don't what?
What?
Don't stray away from the cuck shed.
I don't know what that phrase
is. The cuck shed. It's
do
a
you
concept
think? No, there. No. Can I ask one more question? Do you think it might say something about? Because I the only reason that any of the people in this room know the phrase cuck, or have thought about this, or have ever had a conversation about watching their girlfriend or wife with some other man, is because people like you are obsessed with that terminology and that idea.
Very fixated.
Does that maybe tell you something? Could you use your white mind to deduce
what
a pattern
might
there?
Be there?
You know what?
Okay, but now the point is that you constantly joke about it to try to like deflect that you don't actually enjoy thinking about it.
I mean, I think you may have a point.
It's so funny, but in reality, you actually like you go home and type on the computer and look at that stuff, you know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, well, first of all, buddy, I don't have to get it on the computer. I'm married. But listen, let me ask you.
I was talking to Michael, though.
Oh yeah, no, okay, fair enough. Now, but listen, let me ask you a question. What is your? I mean, since I've been so open about my status. What is are you quite the ladies' man? I imagine that you are rather alpha. Am I right?
In the end, what's the end game here, Sam? What does it matter if I?
It's too embarrassing.
Well, no, wait a second. Hold on.
What does it take away from blacks having low IQ?
Well, no. Wait a second. Now wait a second. We've talked about my being a cuck, and I think it's let's have some mutuality here in terms of this conversation. I'm just curious. You must be a very alpha ladies' man. Is that right?
I would definitely classify myself as an alpha man. Yeah.
Well, but wait a second. You're definitely. I mean, I think everybody can tell you're an alpha.
Definitely.
Definitely. But I'm curious. I'm just curious. Do the ladies appreciate that?
What do you think, Sam? I mean, you can ask your wife.
Well, no, wait a second. Now, are you suggesting that you're dating my wife?
No, what I'm suggesting is you said that you were a cuck, and you said that your wife enjoys being with other men, and since I'm an alpha, and I was assuming your wife is also with alphas, then you could ask her about it.
No. I'm asking if you find that women are attuned enough to sense your alphaness.
What's your personal sexual history?
And you're doing okay with the ladies. I'm just curious.
Definitely. Like when I go into a public place, if I saw you and your wife in a public place and I walked up to your wife and I touched her ass, you know, I don't know what you would do, Sam.
I'm just getting the vibes across the airwaves and just the things that you're saying. That
Kelly is swooning.
You are,
I gotta tell you,
lying through your teeth right now.
I have never seen Kelly this passionate about anything the whole time I've known her.
Wait a second. I want everybody just to be quiet. I want to show. I want a little respect here. I want you to just be honest. Are you technically speaking, are you a virgin?
No.
Are you sure?
I'm 100% positive.
You're positive. And so how long have you been sexually active? For how many years?
Why do you want to know that, Sam?
Well, come on. I mean, I've shared some pretty intimate things with you. I don't think I'm asking for too much.
I think you're asking for a little bit much to know about another male's sexual activities. I mean,
well, I'm not
you
asking
just
anything.
Said
I'm
that
not,
you
I'm
slept
not,
with
I'm
his
not,
wife.
I'm not asking for your activities. I'm asking just give me just a sense of how many years you've been sexually active, because that gives me a sense of just like how savvy you are about these things.
And ever non-paid.
8 years.
8 years of sexual activity. So you really are on top of your game right now.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so now, do you perceive this as, do you feel like you're making a conquest when you are out with a woman and you've been able to have sexual relations with her? I mean, tell us about that a little bit.
I mean, I think that this is, you know, kind of exciting you a little bit too much. Then we've been getting a little bit too stimulated. So maybe we can change the conversation to something else.
Well, I'll tell you what. Listen, we're out of time, but I definitely want you to call back because I think we're getting.
Please.
I think we're moving along. But Michael had one question.
No. This is not a question. This is a serious thing. And I just want to end on a slightly sincere note. Can you email the show? And I know Sam is weirdly, even though he's such a mega cuck, he gets awkward about this. But honestly, it would help him and his wife. You could just submit a headshot, maybe a brief bio, and we could see if he could get you in the rotation. Because I'm sure that Sam's wife would be really excited to meet
well,
you.
Well, I mean, look, I'm not going to
Although she usually prefers black guys.
Let me ask you this. Let me just put it this way.
Another thing we could touch on is why you guys have such a sexual fetish for black men.
Well, fair enough.
Next call.
But I just got to think about this a little bit as to whether or not I'm willing to spring for a first class seat or a coach seat. I mean,
wow, look, she's really asserting yourself all of a sudden.
You know,
maybe a coach
back,
seat. Damn,
bringing
dude.
Bringing you back. I mean, we'll see.
Did you do a push up last week?
but I do appreciate the call. Please call back. Thank you.
You're brilliant in all these ways that you don't understand.
All right, bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
8 years. Sad.
8 years. I mean, sad. So we got a guy. It's all right. Well, maybe, I mean, maybe next time we'll find out how old he is. Maybe, you know, no one, this guy started. I mean,
what if he's single?
Totally on top
of
the game.
Started when he's 10.
All right. Let's do this.
Matt, final. He's single. Okay.
Final IMs. Final IMs. Matt. Hey, everybody. Sam Cedar here.
Donald Trump is a bad guy. Believe me, it's true.
It is true, and you can subscribe to this channel by subscribing to this channel. It's true.